Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 198 of the Distraction Pieces podcast, and I'm joined this week by Alexis Okowo, and it's one of my favourite episodes I've done. I'll get into it. Alexis has got a book out called A Moonless, Starless Sky, Ordinary Women and Men Fighting Extremism in Africa. And the stories in it just blew me away. We get into them in the podcast, so I won't go into tons of detail now, but it's quite fantastic. The stories are so far from the lives that we live, yet somehow so relatable at the same time. It's fantastic. But yeah, how you all doing? Episode 198, right? That means we're pretty close to the big 200. As you know, I've mentioned a few times, I've been recording a lot of podcasts on the bounce at the moment. And I've not been telling you because I like to get them recorded before I announce any, but I feel I can tell you a few. This week, we're doing a double. So I've just got so many podcasts that I'm so excited about at the moment that I'm putting this podcast out on Wednesday, and there's going to be another out on Friday. And on Friday, I'm joined by Charlotte Hatherley of Ash and of Bat for Lashes and of her solo projects. And it's a really good talk as well. We talk about her career, obviously, but we also talk a load about sci-fi. She's doing an event called Space Rocks in association with the European Space Agency. And it's cracking. So we talk a lot about her career, a lot about the fact that her first ever gig in Ash was in front of 50,000 people, and loads of stuff like that. So that'll be out on Friday, and that'll be episode 199. And then we'll get on to episode 200, and I recorded it this week, and you'll be pleased to know it's one of the best I've ever... I'm having a lot this year that are some of the best I've recorded. Some of you will know there's some big guests on the way. I've had some big guests on in the past, some huge names. I think me and Russell Brand teased on Twitter that we might be having him back on for episode 200. And that was one of the plans. I had a few different plans. I don't generally have people back on. And I'll have Russell back on at some point. But I got the opportunity to interview the guest that I'm about to tell you about, which is next week's 200th episode. And it instantly had to become the 200th episode. It was such a great opportunity and great conversation. It's a young lady called Jess Tom, who is a comedian and an actress and theatrical performer, and also happens to have Tourette's. She was on Richard Herring's podcast, and it was one of the best podcasts I've ever heard in my life, and I got to go and see her play Not I, which is a Samuel Beckett play, and that was, it blew me away. And she's just a wonderful, funny, engaging, articulate, intelligent a young lady. And yeah, that had to be the 200th episode. It was at the point I had the realization that, as a lot of you will know or will have noticed, I've got a stutter. It was at the point I had the realization that the rarity of a pod, something that's audio based and conversation based, being a person with a stutter sitting down and talking to a person with Tourette's, that seemed wonderfully exciting and a great opportunity. So that will be episode 200. It's fantastic. Jess performs as Tourette's Hero as well. That's her company she's got. It's a Twitter profile as well, and it's basically, yeah, it's an amazing conversation. So you're going to love that. That's going to be episode 200. I think for episode 201, to kick things off in the next 100, let me have a look at my lineup to make sure I'm not remembering it wrong. But that's one that people have been asking for ages that I recorded a few weeks back. Yes, I do have it lined up as 201 will be Cedric Bixler-Zavala of At The Drive-In. I've got Beans on Toast coming up. I've got Jamali Maddox coming up. I'm hoping to record with Nick Hawks, Michael Venom Page, Mark Goddard and Maxine Peake as well. But there's loads to come, basically. So I'll get into this podcast. As ever, we're brought to you by Speech Development Records.com. That's my record label. It'd be really cool if you went and had a look at the website there, had a look at the web store. But for now, let's hear these amazing and inspirational stories. And it really blows me away. When I had Suad McKennitt on, it blows me away, journalists that literally put their lives at great risk to tell stories that wouldn't get told otherwise. It's amazing. So I hope you enjoy this, and go and check out the book, A Moonless Starless Sky, Ordinary Women and Men Fighting Extremism in Africa. This is episode 198 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Right, I'm joined today by Alexis Okowo. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for giving me your time at the weekend as well. That's even more precious and valuable time. So I appreciate it. But you've written a book called A Moonless Starless Sky, Ordinary Women and Men Fighting Extremism in Africa. I absolutely adored it. I found it absolutely amazing. I need to say at the start, the structure of it I really enjoyed, which seems like an odd thing to start with, but because it's essentially telling four separate stories, and it tells the first half of each story in the first half of the book, and the second half of each story in the second half of the book, which I really like because it invests you in each story. But also, I mentioned at the start because I decided to stop halfway through because we were going to be having this conversation. Okay. I wanted to get to that, know half the story, but not just know all of it and be telling it all myself.
Right,
as such.
Right,
so
right.
Yeah,
okay.
It's kind of, but I found it absolutely fascinating. But let's kind of start with your history and upbringing. So you're American. You're born in America.
Yes.
In Alabama, right?
Well, I was born in Texas, but grew up in Alabama.
Yeah, and how was that?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I actually had a really nice childhood. It was an interesting childhood because I grew up in the Deep South, but I grew up also in a Nigerian household. Right. So I was straddling two cultures constantly where, you know, I went to school with people who grew up in the South, whose families had been in the South for a long time, and there was a very distinct Southern culture. And at the same time at home, you know, I'm immersed in Nigerian food, music, languages. My parents belong to a Nigerian association, and so there are always community gatherings that evoked Nigeria. And so there was a sense of being between two cultures, two places.
Yeah, I mean, that must be a great thing to have those shared and rich experiences, and both as well with real heritage and history. But I had Don Letts on the podcast recently, and he spoke of growing up in London or in Britain in a Jamaican family. He had those influences, but also it kind of meant he didn't feel like he felt like an outsider in both as such.
Yeah.
He felt to Jamaicans, he had a British accent. He clearly isn't Jamaican. And particularly in that time, and I'd imagine in the South as well, it can be to a certain amount of Brits or Americans, he was black. So he's not British in their eyes. So did you have any kind of conflict of lack of identity almost at the wealth of options of identity and leaving you without any as such?
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it, because I did feel that way. I felt almost on the fringe of each culture, not completely belonging, not completely a Black American, even though I am a Black American, but I don't have the same history
as
technical African Americans, because my descendants weren't slaves. You know, my descendants are Nigerian.
Saying, particularly in the South as well, where there's such heritage that is so intrinsic for Black and white Americans because of
the Confederates and the exactly. And the clinging on to slavery in the South. So even more so, but that's again, that's not history that you can be on, have either side attached to.
Right. You know? So it's an interesting experience of being Black in America and experiencing all that goes with that, especially living in the South, but then not being a part of it in a sense, because as you said, I'm not really involved in that complex and intricate relationship between black and white Americans in the South that was forged by slavery, that was forged by, you know, Jim Crow, forged by the legacy of the Confederacy. And so, yeah, it was a strange experience. I mean, I obviously I felt Black and I am Black, but there was a sense of being also other too.
Yeah. Yeah. So when did you kind of fall in love with Africa, with your family's heritage as such? Was that an immediate thing, or was that something that grew over time?
Yeah, that was definitely a thing that came later on, because when I was a kid, I just wanted to fit in. I just wanted to eat hamburgers and do things with my American friends. And I appreciated, I think, in a broader sense, our Nigerian-ness, but it wasn't something I had much curiosity about until college, when I knew that I wanted to be a journalist, and I had grown more interested in sort of living abroad. I studied abroad here in London, and so an opportunity came up to work in Uganda and East Africa.
Oh, wow.
And even then, I mean, I wasn't sort of gung-ho about the continent in the sense of like, oh, I need to be there.
Yeah.
I just thought this could be a fun, adventurous opportunity to go report in Africa.
An opportunity is there that many wouldn't have, so that's got to be a jumped upon. And again, I've not even mentioned now, but you're a journalist and a staff writer at The New Yorker and have been publishing The New York Times and numerous other places. And I think it's kind of a beautiful thing, and it comes across a lot in the book that dual sense of being the feeling like an outsider, but also feeling that loyalty and homeliness to Africa really gives you a sensitivity in approaching these stories. So, but not just, you know, it's got that kind of outsider look at how unusual this is, because again, as we'll get into in the stories, in general, all you know is all you know. So if you're of that society or culture, you don't necessarily spot how unusual some of these things are, or how wrong as some of these things are. So what was it that drew you into journalism and reporting, I guess?
Yeah. Well, I knew I loved writing. I kind of discovered that in high school, through an English class that I had. I realized that I always knew I liked reading, and then I realized I liked writing and I was good at it through some English classes. And then in college, I worked on sort of the campus newspaper and did some internships. And I was like, oh, this is something I like to do, because I'm naturally more of an introverted person. And so I like listening to people, you know, I like listening to their stories. Yeah. It's kind of a treat, really, to kind of just sit with someone and kind of get a glimpse of their life and just listen to what they have to say.
Yeah.
Especially people you would otherwise never have a chance to meet.
Yeah.
And so I was really drawn to the reporting side of journalism and thought, oh, maybe this is something I can do.
The giving a voice to the voiceless. And again, it's something I encounter a lot when talking to people, is a lot of people, no matter how amazing their lives are, it's their lives. So it doesn't feel that interesting. So if you're not some extrovert, then you don't want to just shout about yourself all the time. Because again, the small parts in the book about your life, it's a fascinating life, traveling over to Uganda and reporting. But the book, quite quickly, you become almost anonymous in it. And I think that's a real attribute to your storytelling, and you're burying yourself in the stories of the subjects as such. So you kind of talk about, you started looking into, I guess, the different battles with extremism in Africa. It's something that in the West, we don't hear about that much. We hear a lot about Middle Eastern extremism, but not so much about what's going on in Africa and the variations on different continents. So again, what kind of drew you to that story in particular? Like, was it a case of just being over there and it's kind of unavoidable?
Yeah, I mean, when I started, I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm going to be a conflict reporter or a war reporter. I just wanted to write about people. And inevitably, by basing myself in Uganda, later working in Nigeria, going back again to East Africa, I kept ending up in countries or near countries that were battling extremism or fundamentalism in different ways, you know, whether it was terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab or Boko Haram, or in places like I read about Mauritania where people are battling actual slavery there.
Yeah.
You know, I kept coming across different forms of fundamentalism growing and gaining influence and prominence in countries and watching as people dealt with it. And, you know, in this book, I'm only writing about sort of religious fundamentalism, but when I was reporting over many years, I saw different types. I saw fundamentalism in the spheres of gender, in the spheres of sexuality. You know, I wrote about the gay rights movement in Uganda. And so I kept seeing it crop up in different ways. And I recognized it because it's something that, I mean, frankly, you know, we see in the U.S., you know, we see in other countries different types of extremism.
Sure.
And so, you know, and I noticed that, you know, people were writing about, they're writing about war and they're writing about the terrorist groups and sort of trying to understand the perpetrators. But what interested me more was coming across people who were kind of resisting in some way.
Yeah.
And not even just as activists, just as like people who were like not going to go along with the status quo.
Completely. And that's what I think is possibly identifiable as the most important part in these stories. And the thing that jumped out to me instantly is they're mainly stories of people fighting extremism and fighting from within their religion.
Yeah.
And Christians and Muslims. So identifying that this is our religion and it's being hijacked, it's being taken in the wrong direction, and we're fighting it. Again, it's a stat that people on the right like to ignore a lot, but the victims of most terrorism in recent years are Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
They've mm-hmm. experienced the most. So I love that it's people questioning their religious practices, and that's often seen as a right-wing thing. If you're questioning any religious practice, you're right-wing, you're putting... But all practices, religious, social, governmental, should all be able to be put under some scrutiny.
Of course,
and looked over. So how was that, seeing people fighting for something they love whilst within it, I guess?
Yeah, it was a fascinating experience. I mean, I think of, I don't know if we're getting to the stories yet, but like, especially definitely. When I was in Mauritania writing about...
I'm so glad you've said that, because I had no idea how to say that. I don't know Mauritania, so yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, not many people know about Mauritania, but, you know, I didn't even know much about before going. Yeah. I just knew that it had only outlawed slavery in 1981, and yet it was crazy, still going on. And the activist that I spent a lot of time with there, Biram, he was a radical activist. You know, he did radical things. But he is Muslim, and he believed that imams in that country were using Islam to support the practice of slavery.
Yeah.
And that was just not something he believed his religion did.
Completely.
He just didn't believe that interpretation was correct. But
fighting the use of Islam rather than fighting Islam.
Exactly. And so, you know, I was incredibly, as I said, fascinated by him. I talked with him for hours about this. You know, what did he think his religion promoted, Islam promoted? And, you know, he was very clear about the values he thought it upheld, and how slavery was not at all part of that.
Yeah.
And it was something I admired. You know, he called it Islam made a Mauritania, the interpretation that he believed was incorrect and that legitimized slavery. And it was an incredible experience, because I think especially when you're talking about religious fundamentalism, it is tricky to talk about in a nuanced way and to make sure that you're not painting in broad strokes or generalizations. And the best way to do that is often by talking to people of that religion and seeing what they think and feel, which people don't seem to do enough.
Completely, because there's going to be variation within it. And so many people who are against Islam haven't studied Islam. So mm-hmm. how can you be against something you've not studied?
Right.
You're against what you've been told it is. Mm-hmm. So the people that are going to know it the best are the people are within it. So surely they're the perfect people to talk to. Yet, as you said, they're talked to the least. I thought Abiram's story was absolutely amazing. The fact that he kind of should have been a slave, but wasn't. And his father was fiercely against slavery. His mm-hmm. mother was against slavery, but would take in slaves and kind mm-hmm. of look after them, help them. And
right.
his reaction to that, the thing that I really liked was to arm himself physically and intellectually. So it wasn't simply, I'm going to read it. It was the fact that he saw his father's anger against this, but knew that, with the greatest respect, he didn't have the intellectual capacity to battle it in any way. So he decided to educate himself and to build himself up to start this fight. And the fight was, or has been at times, violent, and it has been at times shocking, but it must have been amazing to see someone so driven, again, to dedicate their whole life to say, I can't make that change how I am now, mm-hmm. so I'm going to better myself to become the person that I need to make that change.
Right. It was. I mean, you know, I was just thinking to myself, you know, his poor wife, because, you know, this guy is single-mindedly driven to this cause. And, you know, based on his family history, his own experience is understandable. But, you know, in this book, you know, I would say that there's a range of people in terms of how much they're devoted to sort of fighting for what they believe. And he's on one extreme end because, you know, he's an activist. You know, this is what he does, this is what he has committed his life to, and it's very intentional, as opposed to, you know, maybe perhaps other people in the book who aren't trying to be activists, but who are just trying to make choices that will let them live their lives happily and as normally as they can.
Completely. And again, it's kind of the boldness of this, the boldness of his actions. I spoke yesterday, and the podcast will go out a few weeks apart, but I spoke yesterday with a Patrice Couleurs, who was one of the founders of Black Lives Matter. And we were discussing how it's often hard publicly to admit that violence is sometimes the answer. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say it's always the answer, and it's generally to say it should be an absolute last resort. But particularly in Africa, there's history that shows that certain civil uprisings and changes only came through bloodshed, if there's such an oppressor and so on and so forth. And Biram's story was an example of that, where they were kind of, him and the team he'd built up were taking on slave owners, and the police, although it had become illegal, weren't arresting anyone. Yeah. They were kind of telling them off. And it took Biram to be arrested. It took a violent clash with the police for the police to then go, okay, well, we're going to start arresting slave owners.
Right.
So it took that kind of... People will always argue that peace should always be the... peaceful protest should always be the way, but it depends on the conflict in hand, right?
It does. And, you know, Biram was comparing the anti-slavery movement there with the beginnings of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, which of course did have violent beginnings. It's funny that later on, you know, when he saw one of the first stories I did about him, he was sort of uneasy about the fact that I had quoted him on his thoughts about violence, which is to say that he did acknowledge that it could be necessary.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's still something kind of taboo to talk about.
Completely.
But, you know, a lot of the independence movements on the continent, of course, did end up violent. And violence ends up being a part of civil uprisings sometimes. And he acknowledged that it was a possibility, especially in society like in Mauritania, where the beliefs about slavery are still so stringent, you know, intractable, that
it
feels like to people there on the right side of things, that's going to take more than just rhetoric to get things to change meaningfully.
Completely. And it's the need now, which again is something we struggle with hugely in society, is to acknowledge nuance in these situations,
right.
And every individual case having its individual causes, to say that some level of violence might be needed. Again, if you're being physically and socially oppressed, the law has changed, but the actions haven't.
Exactly.
How can you say that it has to then just keep saying, no, I don't like this?
Right.
If you've not got that power, it kind of takes that. And one of the powerful images, and indeed a catalyst of a lot that was to come in Biram's story, was in burning the holy books, in a public speech, a public address he was giving. And again, as you said, it was really the highlighting of him saying, I'm against the Islam that's been made here.
Yeah.
I'm not against Islam, but the version of it that's been made here is a fiction and is completely manipulated. I had Suad McKennett on a while back, who's written, who's spoken to many extremists and terrorists over the years, and one of the things, the way that she put it was, religion isn't radicalizing people. People are radicalizing religion,
yeah.
And that's kind of that was a bold stand and a dangerous stand on his part in an Islamic, a Muslim country, an area to burn the holy book. But again, it was a powerful one, because it's saying, look, no, this isn't acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have been an intense and driven a young man that you met there, kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, you must have sensed that in him to be that bold. Because there's there for the dramatic there as well. That's not there is a performance there of going,
completely.
Look at this. And in the way you tell the story in the book, it's beautiful, because I'm kind of thinking, is this what's going to happen? But it's so dramatic and building up to his moment. It's like, this feels like a film, but that gives it that impact, right?
Exactly. And that's how I first learned about him.
Yeah.
I read a short little clip NGO had published saying, you know, Biram, you know, this activist had been recently put in prison because he had burned these legal books considered holy in Islam that imams used to justify slavery. And it was so divisive. Even people in the anti-slavery movement had been shocked and upset that he had done this. And I thought, who is this guy? Like, I have to talk to him. And after I eventually found his contact, and we were emailing actually for months before I even went to go see him.
Yeah.
And I could just tell this was someone who was incredibly passionate and had a lot to say, and would be really open, and that was really appealing to me. I thought, okay, this is someone I want to spend time with.
He's willing to talk honestly and openly.
Yeah.
And again, maybe more willing than most, because of his air for the dramatic.
Well, completely.
And for the, you know, he wants to perform, he wants to show off almost, which that's ideal for a journalist to get that out.
Exactly. And also, you know, I try to be clear in the book, you know, he's an incredible person, but he's also not perfect, and he's not necessarily a hero, right? Yeah. Like,
there's so much of that in the book, which, again, I think is a beautiful. When I saw the title of it and knew of it, I was like, well, it's going to be a lot of, aren't these people wonderful? But a lot of the characters in there either have incredibly flawed pasts or are flawed in some way in general, which, again, it's the real world.
Right.
That's the beauty of it.
Exactly. It's humanity. And, you know, exactly. And I wanted to show that, because there's often when we're talking about conflict or war, we want to paint people as like perpetrators or heroes. Mm-hmm. And there's so much gray in between.
Yeah.
You know, people can be both at the same time.
Yeah.
They can be perpetrators and victims. And so how do we talk about those people, and how do we talk to those people?
Completely. I mean, that's a great one to lead on to. I think the thing I got, so I do a podcast a week, and at the moment I happen to have a really hectic schedule of a lot of people, and the publishers kind of have put your book forward and put you forward. And I politely said, look, I'll give it a quick look, but I'm really busy at the moment. Mm-hmm. And literally, I sat down for one good read of the first chapter or so, and emailed back immediately saying, we have to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons for that was something that just I've not seen talked about and that struck me was the fact that when people argue, when the left even argue against people saying that Islam is a dangerous religion, people argue about Christianity, and they tend to say, you know, the in the past, in history, when they were taking over countries and slaying and all this, and no one really talks about that there's extremism now and recently. And that's the thing that blew me away in this was reading the story in Uganda, I believe it was, that's of Christian extremism. And it's something I hadn't realised at all, because it stems really from Kony, who, as far as I remember, is the first hashtag that went viral.
Right.
It's the first time I remember that being this huge thing.
Exactly.
I swear it's where I learned what a hashtag was.
Right.
Because there was the Get Kony or whatever those different ones were. But I didn't know that it was Christian extremism. And his warped reading of the Bible, instructing his rebels to cut the lips, ears and noses of their victims, to amputate the arms and legs of people who were caught cycling on a Sunday and stuff like that. And that instantly, I was like, right, this needs to be talked about a lot more, because there's a lot of talking, and fairly, about Islamic extremism, because it's an issue, but not nearly enough about the ongoing Christian extremism. So you tell the story of Eunice and Bosco in this one, and the reason it came to mind instantly then was the fascinating side of things, that it's the LRA that you talk about largely here, and I believe it was this one, but generally the members of the LRA are going around abducting people and kidnapping people, but they were generally abducted and kidnapped in their youth themselves. So Bosco was kidnapped as a child, and then 5-10 years on, he's in the jungle kidnapping children.
Yeah.
Because that's all he's been taught. It's weird. I was discussing it with a friend the other day and liking it. It sounds like a weird one, but I guess it's easy to relate to. Liken it to when people talk about footballers or all these other things in the locker rooms hazing people. And when they joined, they hated it and they were bullied. Or even at school, they were bullied and it was horrible. But then they became a senior and they're doing it to the people below them, even though they know how horrible it is, but it's just, it's how it is. It's part of our culture. It's how we do it. And that kind of struck as this, but in obviously a far more extreme way.
Right. Well, see, the thing is, the Lord's Resistance Army was very savvy in a way, right? Because it kidnapped people at their most vulnerable, at their most impressionable, which is to say they kidnapped children. And children were easy to brainwash.
It's a system used by the British and American armies as well,
with
in schools, really pushing be the best you can be, join the army. So, it's a known tactic, I guess.
And even states' armies have done this, but they would kidnap children who were incredibly young, obviously haven't been in school that long, impressionable, and force them to commit atrocities, to kill people, to kidnap people, to the point that sometimes some of the people they kidnapped and forced to become members would buy into that ideology. Not always. I mean, and there were many people who didn't and later escaped, but some did. And that was also the brutal, sickness of it, is kidnapping children and then forcing them often to go back to their home communities to kidnap other children or to kill people, even kill their parents, kill relatives. Mm-hmm. So the kind of experience that children went through in this group was horrific, because on one point, they're committing awful acts.
Yeah.
At the same time, they are the victims of awful acts.
Yeah, it's the ultimate example of being the victim and the perpetrator at once.
Right, and so, these children, they're living in captivity. They're forced to be part of this group because it's either do or be killed.
Yeah.
And they live for years like this often. And then when they finally escape, if they do finally escape or are rescued, they then have to deal with all they did before yeah. as they try to live their new lives.
And it, and it's one where escape and rescue, again, is often resisted or thought of as negatively because of the brainwashing, yeah. the belief that if you do escape, then you and your family and everyone else will be killed, or mm-hmm. even if you're rescued. The brainwashing is such that within a certain amount of time, you're choosing to be there. You want to be there. You're part of it. You've been. It's now your identity and your family.
Exactly.
And that was kind of the real strange conflict of this story in particular, because Eunice was a young girl that Bosco, when he was part of, once he'd become part of the LRA, he kidnapped, and she became his bushwife mm-hmm. as such. And again, we won't kind of go over mm-hmm. the whole story, but mm-hmm. she became his bushwife, and her first sexual experience was him raping her in the bush, which is horrific. But they went on to be a couple right. and to have children. And right. again, it's that realization. And at first I'm reading this and thinking, this is horrible. This is right. Stockholm syndrome. This is everything else. But it's not, because it was the point of realizing exactly as we said that he was a victim as well. And when they kind of realize that they were both a victim is when they start to look into escaping exactly. and getting their freedom and fighting for their independence and against what, you know, living in this horrible situation of, and Eunice as well, the girls would be forced to go and kill women mm-hmm. working in fields and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So mm-hmm. such a horrific set of events, but a bizarre love story as such, because the monster that kidnapped her, she then had to similarly be turned into a monster of sorts through action. So it's such a strange web. How was that as speaking to them, obviously some years on,
mm-hmm.
and trying to get your head round the kind of that journey? Because it's such an impossible, reading on paper is one thing, hearing it from their lips and not having your jaw drop open in shock must have been a tough one to...
Yeah, well, I mean, so when I first lived in Uganda, my first time around after college, the civil war with the LRA, people were thinking it was ending. And so, you know, ended up sort of just mutating into something else. The LRA moved into Central Africa and is still continuing its rampage there. But I had started interviewing victims of the war in the north, and I would talk to former child soldiers. I would talk to people who had their children kidnapped or who had been mutilated or hurt by the LRA. And so I'd had some experience talking to people who were just who would just experience the senseless brutality of this group.
Yeah.
I talked to kids who had come back and who were still young and who were trying to comprehend what the group had done to them, but who were still children, you know, and they were still playing computer games and still playing soccer. And still, yeah. So I could see that complex humanity of children, of young adults who had been in these situations, but who were fundamentally, in a sense, still the same. They still had the same kind of desires and goals for themselves. And so when I then met Eunice and Bosco, I, you know, went in thinking, okay, I know the story a little bit. I know the story of people sure. who have been abducted and who are trying to get past that now. What was new to me was this idea or this reality of women choosing to reunite with the men they had been assigned to while in captivity. That was something I had a very hard time understanding at first, because, you know, like you said, I also thought this must just be based on material need or like some kind of pressure that they feel like if they don't go back with these men that they can't find other partners
who would accept them. Yeah,
exactly.
Sure.
And, you know, I did interview some couples where I did feel like that was the case.
Yeah.
But with Eunice and Bosco, why I was drawn to them is because over the time I spent with them, I did realize that both of them were actively trying to reckon with their past, to sort of to try to understand their culpability and also and also their victimhood, and that they were both very honest about what had happened.
Yeah.
You know, Bosco did not sugarcoat what he did, but I also could tell he felt a lot of regret about it.
Yeah.
And you know, as they recounted their stories to me, as you said, there were clearly moments where they both realized their kinship, their shared sense of loss and pain by both having been abducted, and that's what united them. And I could tell that they clearly cared for each other.
Yeah.
And so over time, over spending time with them, I began to realize something deeper was at play. I didn't know if it was love. You know, they told me it was love, so I believed them. But I think it was very complex. It wasn't just love. It was love, dependency. It was, you know, mutual understanding, a shared sense of trauma. And, you know, I guess if you look at a lot of relationships, it's a combination of a lot of things, right? And so I began to see them as, even though they went through this extremely, you know, to what a lot of people would consider a very unusual experience, the ties that bind them now are not so different than perhaps other couples.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who haven't
Again,
been through that.
It's fascinating. And so it's beautiful to see the simplicity and relatability in such unrelatable stories.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean, on paper, you hear it as like, that's unimaginable. And then there's little glimmers in there that you're like, that's so common. That's so normal. Mm-hmm. That's so human,
right.
Which is a wonderful thing in such horrific circumstances and places.
Right.
So one of the other places you discuss is Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
And Abba and Rebecca are there. And Abba was someone that I warmed to straight away. That, I mean, he became known as Elder,
mm-hmm.
because of his calm and rational wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
This is where Boko Haram were are at their worst and ravaging. So what was kind of the story there? I found it fascinating, the closeness of Elder. Like, it seemed like a tight line of him being someone that sat down and talking to you and fighting Boko Haram, and mm-hmm. someone who's in Boko Haram. It seemed like there was that mm-hmm. close point of
mm-hmm.
of it could have gone either way. And then he had a moment of, this isn't what I believe. This is ridiculous. So how is that kind of that the balance in those situations where it is religion based and where it mm-hmm. is so groups start possibly with good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
And then can be corrupted or led either way.
Right. Yeah, I would say it was not more that he could have joined them, but that once he started his own vigilante group,
yeah,
there was a point where it began to look, you know, unsettling and similar to Boko Haram.
Of course.
So Elder is this guy who, you know, had a pretty happy childhood in Northeast Nigeria. He later became a government bureaucrat, you know, a state auditor. He is also a devout Muslim, has a big family, lots of children, wives. And he saw his hometown being turned upside down by Boko Haram's rebellion. And he was sort of intimately tied to, in a way. He knew the founder of Boko Haram, Muhammad Yusuf. He would greet him and see him around, but he was wary of Muhammad Yusuf's preaching because he saw how radical it was getting.
It seemed at first he mm-hmm. seemed like a guiding force or a positive thing, and then it seemed like Abba had that moment of, this isn't what I think it is.
Exactly.
This is being a corrupted, absolute power mm-hmm. corrupts absolutely. Kind of, mm-hmm. it felt as he was getting bigger and bigger, Abba was like, This is going the wrong way here.
Right. This is not the Islam that I know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so at one point, some years later, and this was 2013, the Boko Haram uprising had begun in 2009. And in those intervening years, you know, the group had wreaked complete terror on Northeastern Nigeria, you know, massacring villages, kidnapping, killing people.
Yeah.
But the thing is that in his hometown of Maiduguri, you know, Boko Haram members were actually sort of almost living openly. Like, people knew who they were. They were living in the neighborhoods, but people were too scared to either confront them or report them because they didn't want to be killed by Boko Haram. Yeah. Until one day when this guy, a taxi driver, performs a citizen's arrest on a suspected Boko Haram member.
By a taxi driver. Right. Goes, no, right.
He performs a citizen's arrest and reports him to the military. The military arrests him. And then everyone's inspired. They're like, yeah, why? We know who these guys are. Let's go after them.
Yeah.
And so they start forming groups by neighborhood. And then over a period of time, a vigilante force begins. And Elder becomes a unit commander of some 8,000 men.
Wow.
And so this is like a huge force. This, the
That started off with sticks and cutlasses kind
right,
of.
Right, right. Homemade weapons.
Arresting or chasing out kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly.
So for then that to grow to 8,000 force of
right
of soldiers, essentially.
Right, and that was just Elder's unit. I mean, there were other units comprised of thousands of people. And so it was an incredible thing because the Nigerian army was incredibly, at the time, frankly, useless in fighting this group. And it really fell on to the burden of the people to protect themselves.
Yeah.
And these brave men and women literally armed themselves to fight the group.
Yeah.
The problem is that later on, their tactics became worrying because they became their own version of law and order in these towns and cities in the Northeast. And so they could arrest anyone they wanted, detain anyone they wanted, and sometimes kill anyone they wanted.
Yeah.
And people became nervous about their power.
Yeah, and it is a scary one because we've seen it a lot over recent years with when uprisings occur because of desperation, you know, unavoidable uprisings, there then gets to a point where if the people rising up don't know how to control this power and how to run things, it can become a dangerous thing because there were points in this story where he was kind of saying, look, I don't tell any of my people to be violent. I don't support that.
Right.
But kind of an implication of, but what they do without my knowledge is like, well, exactly. That's not good. That's how bad things start happening. That's how that then becomes within your knowledge. And then that you then become someone who needs to be overthrown as well. So it's a tough one, right?
It's tough.
It started with the best intentions, but again, it's still the best intentions via your interpretation of your religion or your interpretation of what is good for your community.
Well, yeah, that's what it is. For what are you allowed to do when your life is upended so extremely? Like, how extremely are you allowed to go?
Yeah.
To what lengths are you allowed to go to protect yourself, your way of life, your family? You know, one might say
an extreme situation. You can understand it being extreme. You
exactly.
can understand that being an extreme reaction.
Exactly. But. So, you know, this is a guy who is not an activist. He's just someone who got caught up, and a lot of what he and his colleagues have done is admirable.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's also sort of a case study in these very drastic situations when people react drastically.
Yeah.
What is allowed? What isn't? What is the moral code here? Is there one? I mean, I think there is, but I think that it shifts a little bit.
It's tough, and it shifts a lot. Yeah, because again, it's that kind of you push to this out of desperation, and all of a sudden you're the person that people are looking to for guidance and leadership. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I was reacting. I'm not a leader.
Right.
You know, I'm standing up against something that's horrendous, but it's such a tough one because so many of these groups seem to walk that confusing line of even confusing line of public support and fear.
Yeah.
There seems to be a lot where people are, no, these are our, we're against the government or we're against this. It's like, well, no, now the people that were against the government are more dangerous, and it's such a complex battle, I guess. The fourth story, again, I loved because it's so at odds with all of these, but equally as important, as you kind of touched upon about people just are living their lives and that being a stand in itself. And there's a lot there, but it's Aisha in Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially it's a story. I mean, we've talked about resistance through violence. We've talked about resistance through defecting. We've talked about resistance through the burning of books and protest. This is essentially resistance through basketball, mm-hmm. which is it sounds like the name of a film, but it isn't. And right. It's a fascinating one because she was a young girl who loved basketball, mm-hmm. and is good at basketball, mm-hmm. and wants to play basketball. Mm-hmm. Yet it was seen by certain areas of her religion or elders that's not for a woman to do. The clothes right. that they wear to play basketball, yeah. and things right. like that. That's not what they should be doing. So she would, but I think it was at the age of 14, mm-hmm. she got her first death threat in a phone call.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Somalia. Amazing. Right. So, I mean, Somalia is a really interesting place because before the advent of fundamentalists, you know, like Al-Shabaab and extremely conservative clerics, women actually had a lot of freedom. You yeah. know, the women's basketball team in Somalia a couple of decades ago was one of the best in East Africa. You know, Aisha's mom played in the club league there. A lot of the girls who play basketball now in Somalia, their mothers played, yeah. you know, went around with their hair uncovered in afros and in shorts. And so these girls grew up with these stories. They knew the kind of rights and freedoms their mothers had and were entitled to, and yeah. they feel entitled to those same things.
Yeah.
Even though they're living in a society now where militants will call them up and say, oh, I'll kill you if you keep playing basketball and wearing shirts and pants outside.
Yeah.
You know, and so this is a serious thing, you know. I interviewed one girl whose friend was killed by militants a couple of years ago. But these girls, you know, they're on the internet. They had their mothers who played basketball. They know what they're entitled to do as teenage girls. They know the lives they should be having, yeah. which is to play any sport they want, you know, hang out whoever they yeah. want to, yeah. you know, go out, have fun. And so they live their lives like that, even though by living their lives like that, it's at great risk sometimes.
Completely.
And it
is one of the more unusual stories as well because of that. I mean, we spoke earlier of all you know is all you know, but mm-hmm. this is an area that extremism kind of came to mm-hmm. and wasn't always there. It's not that this is our history and we're trying to fight against it. It's like, mm-hmm. no, our history, we'd already fought against it, but mm-hmm. Somalia kind of became a hotbed for extremism where people were chased out of other places kind mm-hmm. of thing, it seemed. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of, that seemed like somewhere that it appeared. So even harder to just accept these rules when yeah. you've grown up seeing all the other options mm-hmm. and seeing that this isn't how it has to be or exactly. necessarily should be.
Exactly. And knowing that is incredibly powerful to a lot of women. You know, I think there's an idea that, like, women living in societies just go along with it. Like, they stay inside, they cover themselves up. Yeah. And, like, of course, a lot of women do that to survive.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of shades, a lot of different types of women. And, you know, on the bolder side are these teenage girls who are probably so bold because they are teenage girls.
Yeah.
Who refuse to go along with the status quo, who refuse to just, you know, stay inside. At the same time, they're not activists. Yeah. They're not trying to be heroes.
But they strength of it, again, the fact that she argued against the mm-hmm. the phone death threats.
Right.
Would argue and say, no, this is something I should be allowed to do. And
right.
and shortly after that came some in-person death threats, one with where they were picked up by mm-hmm. a taxi.
Right.
Oh, was it in?
Sorry, is this too loud?
No, no, that's fine. Okay, it's okay. I like a bit of atmosphere.
Okay.
Shows you in the real world.
Okay.
Yeah, the fact that her and some friends were picked up by a taxi, and it was a trap. Essentially, it was someone who knew who they were and what they'd been doing. That they'd been playing basketball
mm-hmm.
and took them down an alleyway, and they were threatened. But again, they fought against that
mm-hmm.
and managed to escape and get mm-hmm. a policeman. And to return to basketball the next week is
right.
an insane thought in that situation. Right. But it's something that they wouldn't just accept, which right. is amazingly
right.
powerful, as powerful and inspirational as being on the front line, right? Because you're not a soldier and you're not forced into that situation. You're saying, this is my right and this is my passion and it's what I want to do.
Right, and also made me think of, like, you know, in societies where, you know, violence sort of, like, where violence in the form of terrorist attacks or things like that become so common, you know, how people's version of normal shifts in the way, you know, if there is a risk of going out and there's an explosion, things like that, how does your life alter? And does it return to, you know, obviously people can't just stay inside all the time. They have to go to work. They have to go to school.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily think that the fear lessens, but just this sort of ability to cope better maybe arises.
One of the coldest and most, again, most of what I read on her story was, wow, this is such positive, but the sadness when you spoke of her brother being caught by a stray bullet and her response being, this is life.
Right. And
no one lives forever.
Right.
I mean, it's true and it's accurate, but for a young girl to have that acceptance, I don't know, it seems sad. Again, in many ways, it's reality. And yeah, I think in the West, we have a negative, too negative a relationship with death, because again it is something that is, it does happen to everyone. We shouldn't be as scared of it, and as it shouldn't be as taboo, but despite believing that, it was still hard to read someone with such an acceptance of that's how it is here.
And it was hard to see, I mean, because I thought, you know, obviously she was sad and she was upset about her death, but I thought, wow, to be in a place and to now have the philosophy that, you know, it happens a lot. I did feel, I also felt sad.
Yeah. That was tough. Well, I'll start to round things up as we're getting towards an hour now, but how do you prepare yourself to go into these situations and to talk to these people? What research do you do, or what precautions do you take? As I was reading it, I kept getting very worried for you to make sure you, because again, it's these crazy dangerous situations, and speaking to people who are under threat in many ways, are rebels, are at odds with dangerous people. So what is your approach, and what is your preparation, I guess?
Yeah, well, before I go anywhere, I'm definitely reading a lot about that place, and books and news articles, and talking to people who've been there, who have written about it. But on a very practical level, when I'm going to a place that's more dangerous, like Mogadishu or northeastern Nigeria, I'm trying to, talk to a lot of people who've been there, who can get the recommendations on places to stay, car services to use, you know, the safest ways, basically, to be in that place. And then I'm also trying to make connections with people who are there and who I can connect with, who could either, if I need it, work as an interpreter or as a fixer, or just be someone I can connect with to, like, buy them a meal or a drink and get their advice about being in a place. Often maybe a local journalist or, you know, maybe someone who works at a local NGO in that place. So when I was in Mogadishu, I had the luck of connecting with a Somali young woman who actually lives in Abu Dhabi, and she's a filmmaker, and she was also doing something about women's basketball in the country.
Yeah.
And so for my second trip there, we ended up connecting and traveling at the same time. And we were doing moving around a lot together, which was great because even though the first time I'd been there, I had, you know, I was traveling with security, which was just not ideal for when you're trying to interview subjects.
Yeah.
You know, you want to go into their home and then tell them, well, I'm just going to have these armed guards outside. You know,
it doesn't make it. You're not going to get the most relaxing conversation.
Exactly. Yeah. So the second time, it was a little bit more risky because we were moving around with no security, but I was moving around with someone who was Somali, who knew the city relatively well.
Yeah.
So we could go around, go into people's homes and stay there without really, you know, worrying about standing out because we had some, like, big SUV or, like, guards in the street. Yeah. And, you know, I sort of wore local dress and tried to blend in as best as I could. I mean, people knew I wasn't Somali, but, you know, I tried as much as I could. And then when I was in northeastern Nigeria, I, you know, went to the town, Chibok, where a lot of schoolgirls were kidnapped in 2014, yeah. which was a very dangerous journey. But I traveled with a resident of the town, and I relied on his advice, like, let's travel on a market day where the more people are around. I stayed at his house. So I really relied on the generosity and guidance of people from these places to help me travel as safely as possible. You know, there's only as safe as you can be in unpredictable conflict zones, but I tried.
But yeah, that's having people who you know and can trust to take advice from, and that you can comfortably go, right, I will take your, if you say that this isn't safe, I'm not going to argue. It's like, oh, come on, let's just get this last bit, let's just do that. You're going to go, all right, if you think it's not safe, then let's call it a day.
Yeah, that's completely my philosophy. I will take your, like, let's go when we say let's go, or let's try it when you say we can try it. I am not someone who's going to, like, put my life or other people's lives at risk just for the sake of a story.
Of course.
At least I try not to.
Yeah.
I mean, I still did go to, you know, these places, but I tell myself I try to do it as safely as possible.
It's as calculated a risk as possible.
Yes, yeah.
So were there any writers or journalists or documentary makers that kind of drew you towards this as a path, as a... Because again, it is an unusual one, because regardless how calculated, it is still a risk. It is still, it's going, and it's not just chasing after the big story either. It's chasing after the small stories, the untold stories, which is what makes it more unusual, I guess, and stands out.
Mm-hmm.
So were there anyone that kind of were your inspirations or guidance there?
Yeah, I mean, when I was growing up, I loved Christiane Amanpour for her sort of like level-headed, reasonable reporting in like very extreme situations. Like, I feel like she never exaggerated things or kind of, you know, made them a spectacle.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that. And there's a writer, Wendell Stevenson, who I appreciated. She wrote a book on Georgia years ago. And it was a book of stories about Georgia, her people there, her experiences. And I also appreciated the way she just told the stories of like ordinary people in their lives, but made them seem relatable and interesting. And, you know, I strove towards that, because even though I was writing about considerably more extreme situations, I did want to try to tell the stories of ordinary people in their lives and not make them seem so exotic or so out of comprehension.
Yeah. Is there something in particular that would make you know, oh, this is a story I need to tell? Because again, I guess being a journalist anyway, you're not, correct me if I'm wrong, but you weren't necessarily initially simply chasing four stories to go in this book. You're kind of wanting to gather and tell as many stories. And then I guess you kind of going, right, these are the four that I need to take further.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you ask that, because as I now work on my second book project, I find the people I'm drawn to share some similarities with these people, even though it's a completely separate context. It's now in America.
Yeah.
But I'm drawn to people who make what I find are really compelling decisions in their life, or really compelling choices that all of a sudden take them on a different path, whether the decisions were forced upon them or they made them themselves, and how those decisions or what those decisions reveal about these people and about the way they think and about the way they feel in contexts that are very distinct. So with the four people, six people in this book, you know, they obviously all found themselves in situations they wouldn't have expected.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in the way they decided to go along or not go along with them, you know, often not go along with them, and why they made those decisions, which to me are, you know, very big decisions.
And the points at which they make those decisions.
Exactly.
I think it's all the more amazing if someone has gone along with something for a certain amount of time to then fight back and resist. So I've told the story numerous times, but when I worked in a record store years ago, I had a security guard, and there was a big guy, a shaven head, bulldog tattoo on his arm, and I was like, this isn't my kind of guy. And then I got to know him, and he'd been brought up a racist and been brought up on the far right, But he was working at that point as a security guard to save up to get a laser, a tattoo removal of the bulldog on a Union Jack, because he's learned that that's not the way. And that was, for me to grow up not racist, felt kind of easy because I had a nice family who felt that way. But it struck me as all the more impressive and empowering of someone who not had every right to be racist, but it wouldn't be surprising considering the family he grew up in that were all racist, that he was fighting against that and had chosen otherwise. And that's the thing that was fascinating in the book, is a few of the people. There's some that are fighting it from day one, and God bless them. That's amazing to see that drive from an early age. But there's others who you'd think, wow, that takes a lot to be that far down the line. And again, particularly with a Eunice and Bosco as examples, when you've gone that far, when you've done stuff that it's easier to accept if you stay in that life. It's right, well, that's how life is. If you step out of it, you then have to deal with the guilt and the consequence. So that made it all the more powerful of when people choose to make that fight,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly. And that's it. Yeah, as you said, the resistance of defection. I hadn't even thought about it like that. But it's true, that's part of it.
Yeah.
Just by leaving all that they've known for most of their lives,
yeah,
was an incredible risk, and now they are trying to cope with all the guilt, all the responsibility, and still, you know, provide a new life for their children.
Yeah, of course.
And so
I'll wrap things up now and let you enjoy your weekend and have some tourist time in London and stuff. What's ahead, and where can people keep up to date with everything?
Yeah,
that you're doing, because again, it's the book is the focus of this, and I urge everyone to read it. But you're a writer in general, so you know there's constantly things to keep up with.
Right.
Obviously, another book's on its way, but yeah,
right, yeah. So now that I've finished A Moonless Starless Sky, I am working on a new project in Alabama, actually.
Yeah.
My home state. I'm working on some stories there that will come out later, and then I'm also working on a second book there that is exploring why Alabama has been such a prominent stage for the best and worst results of the American experiment.
Right.
So that's something I'm exploring right now. You know, America is also in an extreme situation right now, an extreme political crisis, and people are reacting extremely. And there's a lot to delve into there.
Truly,
But otherwise, yeah, I'm online. I'm on Twitter and Instagram and all the platforms.
Perfect. Well, well, thank you very much for your time.
And thank you so much.
For giving a voice to these stories, because it's rare to kind of hear such stories and be certain that if I wasn't reading them in this book, I would never have heard them. You know, the nature of these people and the obscureness and distance of where they are. These stories aren't stories that feel like they would have been told otherwise. So, yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was episode 198. What an amazing young lady, right? I was blown away. I was so pleased and honoured to get to have this conversation. It's always a nerve-wracking one when, as I mentioned a few times, if it's someone you've not met. And in this case, someone I've not really had any interaction with, because a lot of it was set up by the publishers and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was amazing. I think those stories are fascinating. The fact that those stories wouldn't exist if it weren't for this book and the hard work of Alexis. They certainly wouldn't traveled as far as they have. I was chatting with I recorded a podcast with Beans on Toast, who's a folk musician and great dude, and I was talking to him about the Giacomo Brown album that came out on Speech of Element Records, and that's an album that is from an artist who had no desire to tour or play live. He played live twice, didn't see the appeal, I had no desire particularly to do interviews or photo shoots because I had no desire to be a career musician, but had written this amazing album. And I had to twist his arm to get us to allow us to release it. And we released it, and it got 8 out of 10 in Uncut magazine, all this kind of thing. It's an amazing record, but it wouldn't have existed without Speech Development Records. And it's that kind of thing. I love stuff like that that wouldn't have travelled, that gets a chance to have a life because of someone just by chance giving it this platform. So, yeah. Anyway, I'm rambling on. As I mentioned, you're getting double podcasts this week. Two amazing, inspirational ladies. So, yeah. Next week, on Friday, tune back in as I'll be chatting to Charlotte Hatherley of Ash. And we talk about loads of stuff. We talk about Ash. We talk about touring. We talk about being in Backflash's band. We talk about a lot of sci-fi nerding out, catching up on what she thought on Altered Carbon, Mute, Annihilation, all the Netflix ones, and all sorts of sci-fi from the 70s onwards. So we have a good nerd out about that, and we talk about her upcoming event at Space Rocks, which is in association with the European Space Agency. It's a live event. Go and Google it. Go and look at their website. It's in a couple of weeks. So check that out, and there'll be more on Friday. Lovely. See you later. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.